What are you doing here? I asked. In L.A.
Working,
she said. She slipped a cigarette between her lips and I lit it. She hadn't smoked when we met. She used to make fun of me and my hipster smokes. The Surgeon General has determined that knowing me is hazardous to your health. You have a chute, didgeridoo with you?
No,
she said, sounding irritated as she blew the smoke out her nostrils.
Not that kind of work. Your kind of work. Messy, ugly, probably violent. And I don't need didgeridoo running after me to make sure I don't fall down and burst my ass. I can handle this myself, Latham. She's not my mother, and you sure as hell are not.
Okay, I said, just making conversation. I sipped my beer. You want to tell me what this caper is about?
No,
she said.
I can deal with it.
She paused for a second.
That's exactly how that feels, by the way, for all the times you ran off on your own. Enjoy it. What are you doing out here other than rekindling your rock and roll career?
Skip Trace, I said. A Fey noble lost his daughter, so I'm out here looking for her.
Fey,
Magdalena said.
So, Tori's involved in this. You're doing it for her?
No, I lied. Magdalena shook her head.
You know how I can always tell when you're lying, Latham?
I made a low groaning sound and rubbed my face.
Your lips are moving. Of course it has to do with her. Most things that get you motivated in your life have to do with your ego or your kinda dead girlfriend.
Hey, I said. I was with you. I tried. I really fucking tried. I stopped drinking. I cut back on the smoking. I even kept you as far away from the fucking Satan thing as I could. I tried, okay?
I know you did,
she said.
I did too. It was just bad. We were just bad. I tried to give you what I thought you wanted and needed, but were too stubborn to let yourself have. I tried to love you, and you kept pushing me away, banging your head against that wall, Latham. It wears you out, too.
I heard an echo of Anna's words earlier. I know, I said. I'm a selfish son of a bitch. It wasn't you. You gave me every scrap of you freely, with love, with really good fucking love. I just fucked it up. Magdalena watched her cigarette burn toward entropy.
I finally figured out why you're still mooning over Tori,
she said. Don't, I said.
No, Latham, you need to hear it,
she said.
Because she's the perfect woman for you. She's unobtainable, unreachable. You can stay faithful to her because any trespass is forgiven. You have memory and grief instead of messy living, clumsy, uncertain love. A dead woman is the perfect partner for a man who doesn't want life to touch him.
I stayed silent. There was nothing I could say to any of that. Magdalena reached out and touched my hand.
I was angry and hurt when we parted. I thought you had presented a lie to me about who you are. But you did tell me the truth. You did warn me. I just lied to myself.
What are you working on? I asked. It sounds dangerous.
And now we run as fast as we can away from the real danger,
she said, smiling.
The ugly truth.
She crushed out the cigarette in the glass tray on the table and then stole a sip of my beer. She made a face, and for a second she was the old Magdalena again.
It's about her,
she said. Magdalena never said her name if she could help it, as if the act alone might summon her, and it actually might. The dumb witch that messed with you before we met, I said. You said she was in the life and she tried to make you her slave, not just her sub. Why the hell would you poke into anything dealing with her?
I had met a girl on FetLife, Jeannie,
she said.
It was a tantric group. She was starting to develop some abilities. It sounded like she might be like you, and didgeridoo, and me. Then this woman, this dom, was suddenly in her life. This bitch sounded a lot like my old bitch. I tried to warn her and get some more information, and then Jeannie stopped answering me. Greener tractor for me, and here I am. I'm going to find her, and I'm going to help her, the way I wish someone had helped me when she had her claws in me.
Magdalena, you told me this psycho was building up a paramilitary cult with her as the goddess. You have no idea how powerful she might be, what kind of firepower.
And she has no idea how strong I've become,
she said. I could see something cold and beautiful set behind her dark eyes.
I'm not running away, and I'm not leaving a good person to twist on the end of that monster's little finger.
When do we start?
We don't, she said. I'm doing this myself, Letham. I figured you, of all people, would understand that.
I do, it's just... Does Didgeridoo know you're up to all this? Does she...
Approve? No, she doesn't.
Magdalena said, her eyes darkening. I knew the look. She was getting pissed. I was pretty sure our mutual friend and her teacher, Didgeridoo, had already had this conversation several times.
I don't need anyone's permission to do this, any more than you do. The power is all the permission I need.
It could have been me saying the words. I had said them or something damn close many times in my life. I suddenly felt very sorry for all the people I had said them to. They had only been trying to help me, protect me. You live long enough, you time travel, you run back into yourself. I nodded. You're right, I said. You're free to do what you want. You've been trained. You know how to use your powers and how to defend yourself. Just my granny tried once a long time ago to warn me off a path I was on. I didn't listen, darling, and that's part of the reason I'm the way I am now. It wasn't anyone's fault but mine, but you wander far enough down some roads and you can't make your way back again. I don't want that for you, neither does Jerry. Please just try to remember who you are and who you're not. She stood still holding my hand. I rose with her, and we looked into each other's eyes. Our arms and bodies fell into instinctual positions. We hadn't been so long apart yet that we had forgotten them, forgotten how our skin felt together. I was holding her, and she was against me holding me. She looked up, and I saw the intent forming behind her eyes and then almost on her lips. She almost said it, but then she remembered she had promised herself she wouldn't. I was proud of her for that, and more than a little sad that I had made this sweet, open human being become just a little more guarded with her heart. I didn't deserve to hear those words again. She kissed my cheek and hugged me fiercely. Then she let me go, and I let her go. Be careful, I called out as Magdalena reached the door. You're not alone out there, you know. She nodded and smiled with her eyes. She was so beautiful, she made my chest ache.
Neither are you, she said. Don't you forget that. Ghosts are terrible backup, old man.
She was through the door and out onto the street. Lives intersect, we circle, we knot, we untangle, we part. The bartender waited a few minutes and then came over.
Hey, man, he said. You need anything else? I'm headed out.
I paid him $300 to slip me a bottle of Herradura tequila, his half a pack of shitty Marlboro Reds, and a baggie of Fett. Now armed with my own backup, I headed out of the empty bar and onto the blissfully uncaring streets. 10. It was after 4 in the morning, and I still had no idea where Duane was. I bumped some of the speed I had picked up off the barkeep in the back of a cab and chased the pills with the Herradura. The cabbie didn't give a shit. My kind of guy. I felt like fine grit had settled in me. I was tired but amped. Drunk but wired. I was walking in a low-resolution dream, grainy and as flat and colorless as 4 a.m. Enough fucking around. I wasn't going to spend the rest of the night hitting homeless camps or wandering down to Venice Beach to have to deal with gang assholes. Louis would know where Duane was if I could get Louis's attention, which was sometimes easier said than done. I decided to try to check with one of the best connected street operators I knew in L.A. Take me to a rooftop, I said. Make it a high one. That got a raised eyebrow in the rear view. I snagged a chintzy ring from a bubblegum machine at a Circle K. I had the cabbie stop there to get more smokes, buy a cheap-ass prepaid cell phone, and take a piss. The ring was fake gold metal that bent like tinfoil, and it had a little bright red fake plastic transparent jewel and a shitty prong setting on the front. It was perfect. Louis would love it. The cab dropped me off at the Ziggurat City Hall. There's an observation deck set up for folks to gawk on the 27th floor. It was, of course, closed at 5 in the morning, but I made my way up there through a combination of black belt level bullshit and some subtle use and abuse of the Ajna chakra to fuck with folks' nervous systems to make them simply not look where I was at any given moment. In 10 minutes, I went from curb to rooftop. Suck it, Gandalf! It was a hell of a view. I liked having it all to myself, but I didn't have long to enjoy it. I was running out of time to make shit happen. Dawn was our best shot to hit the gangbuster sheltering Demir, and that wasn't far off. I placed the toy ring on the edge of the deck, smoked, drank, and waited. 20 minutes later, a section of night tore free from the graying sky. It glided down, great black wings fluttering, dropping and landing with a loud caw.
Nice,
the crow said, examining the ring with quick pivots of his head. His voice was a warm baritone, rich and deeper than you'd expect. Hey, Louie, I said, how you been?
Well, 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 it's my favorite hillbilly.
Louie replied, making quick hops toward me on the ledge.
How you been, Ballard? I hear you were busy up in Michigan a while back. Something about a corrupted water elemental?
Yeah, I said. They fucked up the water there really bad, and the thing kind of went berserk. It was killing sewer workers, started coming above ground to kill people. I took care of it.
Good for you, good for you, Louie said. So, I heard you were the devil's bitch these days, too.
How can a guy with no visible ears hear so much shit? I asked. I've more or less wrapped that bad business up, I said. How about you, old bird? How you been?
Ah, don't even get me going, the crow said. These youngsters in the murder, I swear to Bran, they're killing me. I hope I didn't do all that to my clutch warden when I was a young punk.
I suspect you did worse, I said, knowing you.
Yeah, well, you're not exactly the guy to be bringing up past behavior now, are you? Mister tried to fool around with one of the Corvus noble ladies when he was just a lowly crow.
Louie made a sound like a toy machine gun. It passed for laughter from him. Hey, I said, all that clash shit aside, she was totally into me. I had met Louie years ago back in my Nightwise days. Sometimes the souls of dead humans are taken in by crows and allowed to be reborn as the birds. Lou was one of these ghost-born crows. He had the lifespan, the brain, and the voice of a man, but could interact with either society. Given his unique talents, Lou had become an invaluable agent of both the Nightwise and what passed for nobility in a society full of thieving, practical joking smartasses, the Corvus Court. I had to become a crow for a time to help a transplanted human soul solve his own murder, and Louie had been a good partner and a good friend during all that. Come to think of it now, looking back, I have more in common with crows than I do people.
Hey, the Maven, know you're in town? Lou asked.
I don't work for that asshole anymore, I said. I don't have to fucking report in to her. I quit, remember?
Fired, Lou said. Well, I'm still Nightwise, so she'll pretty much know soon, my boy.
You'd rat me out.
Now you're just being insulting, Lou said. I'd crow you out. Hey, the lady has some really good sparklies, and she appreciates my info.
He looked over to the ring still sitting on the ledge.
Unlike some people.
You'll get it eventually, I said. How's the radio gig going? Lou was the Midnight to Six DJ on K-Rock. He'd been doing it for years under various assumed names, and with the help of a line of eventually irritated beyond reason human assistants. Not many people outside the life knew the voice talking to them in between sets of alternative music, and the night was not human.
Meh, he said. It's a living for a bird. I don't know how the hell the humans who do it get by. It's all a pain in my ass, Feathers. I gotta renew my FCC license, and that's a load of bullshit. I got this new kid helping me. He's a total meat wagon. Big, muscled-up, blonde surfer, sexy as fuck, but he's dumb as a fucking turkey at an NRA convention.
Speaking of cute surfers, I said, I'm looking for Dwayne, and I'm running out of time.
When aren't you? Lou said. I figured you were looking for someone tonight, the way you've been blundering all over town.
Well, if you were keeping such good tabs on me, then I'm sure you know exactly where he's at right now, I said.
Oh, sure.
Lou said, turning his head sideways to admire the toy ring, then looking back up at me.
It's yours, I said, and then dropped my hand down over the ring a second before the crow could grab it with his beak. Once you tell me where to find Dwayne.
Lou made the machine gun laugh again.
Okay, okay. He's over on West 69th.
South L.A., I said, over by Figueroa. What the fuck is he doing there?
That, Lou said, will cost you another pretty.
He gave me the address. I headed for the door to the observation deck, already pulling out the cell phone to call Dragon. Thanks, Lou, I said. Enjoy the shiny. I may have some more of those for you soon. I'm looking for a missing person.
You picked a good city to do that in, he said. We got plenty to choose from.
He started to pick up the ring with his beak, but then he paused.
Hey, Ballard, one more thing.
Yeah, I said, looking back through the open door. I saw a mischievous glint in the crow's eyes.
Oh, nothing, he said. You'll figure it out. Tell Dwayne I said hi.
Yeah, you tell the maven I said fuck off. Again the machine gun laughed, and then a quick caw-caw of excitement over the new treasure. Then Lou was airborne with the ring. He flew away from the brooding, still-hidden sun. I called Dragon in the cab headed to West 69th. I told her the address.
That's six-pack territory, she said. A bunch of different gangs have carved that area up, Ballard. You're walking into the ES-62 Crips house. If any of their buddies want to join in killing your ass, you could have half a dozen gangs on you. You want me to meet you there?
No, I replied. You get everything set up and get our final destination locked down. We'll meet you there.
You sure you don't want me to at least contact some other members of the order to—
No fucking nightwise, I said, sharper than I had intended. I rubbed my face, felt the scruff of my beard shadow, and felt very old and very tired. All of my cheats were coming undone. I fumbled around to see if I still had any more drugs from my fans, eschewing the weed in my present condition, or another hit of speed from the bartender. Nope, I was tapped out, not even a fucking cigarette. The last fucking thing I need is the goddamn maven or some of her robots up my ass about getting out of her fucking town. Dragon chuckled.
It's hard to believe you used to be her golden boy.
Fuck her! I said, her fucking town bullshit, it's my fucking town.
I'll be sure to bring a tape measure, Dragon said. If she shows, you two can have a pissing contest, and I'll see who gets greater distance.
She hung up. I groaned a little and laid my head back. It was starting to throb. It was 5:45 when the cab dropped me off a half block from the address and took off like a bat out of hell. I walked, hell, weaved a bit down the sidewalk. There was a flare again. My venerable, damaged, cranky, unresponsive nervous system couldn't ignore the presence of power, real power, close by, too close. I spun and tried to think of some kind of a defensive charm, something simple, but my brain was flat. There was nothing there, and the power I had felt was gone, just like in the bar. I tried to convince myself I was getting paranoid. I kept swearing off coke and speed, and this was one of the myriad reasons why. But the never-sleeping, rat-brained bastard in me knew better. That was not a paranoid shiver. That was someone in the fucking life messing with me. I quickened my pace and headed for the address Lou had given me for Dwayne. There were about 12 expensive cars parked on the street and in the narrow drive around the shitty-looking house on 69th. Urban ghosts, men standing around on street corners, huddled, all sporting Crips blue, eyed me as I walked up to the door. I had their attention. They started to come up, but then they whispered to each other and glided back into the darkness. I looked around to see what had chased them off, and that was then I noticed the bloody streaks of fingerprints of a partial handprint on the slightly ajar door. I tried to clear my skull of all the shit I had poured in there and managed to push out some of my fatigue and the fuzz of the drugs and booze. I pushed the door open and found a severed hand greeting me on the floor and a pool of fresh blood. I stepped around it. There was a dead man on the stairwell that went to the second floor. He had a pistol in the one hand he still had attached. I smelled no cordite. I didn't think he had gotten a chance to get around off. To my right was a large room that may have been designed as a living room. If it was, then some serious cosmic irony was on display. Dead men were everywhere, at least a dozen. Unfired guns, thousands of dollars in loose bills, and cooling bodies carpeted the floor. Overturned card tables and broken laptop computers were scattered around the room. One laptop still showed a spreadsheet program on its blood-smeared screen. There was a dead man impaled to the smashed plasterboard wall with a folded metal chair. Next to him was a whiteboard that was sectioned off into a grid with names and odds. Painted over the grid in blood were the words, "Second warning, next I get SRS." The impaled man had a loaded Uzi machine gun lying at his feet. No spent shells on the floor anywhere, no stray bullet holes this kind of firepower produced. I heard a scraping noise farther back in the house, and I moved over the dead toward the sound. The next room back was a dining room. It was adjacent to a kitchen. The room smelled the way I imagined hell would smell. A musty, wet animal scent, the stink of loosed bowel mixed with blood and fear piss. There were more dead here, a lot, bodies stacked on bodies. More impotent guns, more cash discarded as casually as the lives had been. At the center of the room was a makeshift arena made up of doors turned sideways and connected to hinges so they could be folded up. There were two dogs, a chocolate pit bull and a reddish-brown Rottweiler mix in the center of the arena. The Rottweiler was dead, his throat torn out. His body was crisscrossed with old scars. The pit was struggling to keep breathing, his eyes crazy with fear and pain. His wounds all came from fighting the other dog. I knelt by the pit and ran my hands over his sleek, muscled flank. A tiny whine came from the dog. The anger in me washed away the need for sleep. The soft wall of the drugs was torn down to let all of this pour in. "I already tried to help him, Ballard," a familiar voice called out from another part of the house. "He's too far gone, brah. Too close to the dark." As if in response to the stimulus of the voice, one of the men in the pile of bodies moaned. A bubble of blood popped from his open mouth. His one remaining eye opened and moved about lazily. He said something in Spanish I couldn't make out, but it was the human equivalent of the sound the dog had made, a last feeble groan for help, for life. I wasn't thinking. I wasn't casting a spell. I was pulling up old wires and conduits that the universe had seen fit to give me access to. This wasn't magic, it was rage. And to be honest, the two, at their core, had always felt very pure and similar to me. I clutched my hand, claw-like, on the wounded man's face and kept my other hand gently against the dying pit's side. The man's energy was still vital, was still strong. He could live with immediate medical care. I reached down into this anonymous man's soul, his life force, the well of all he was, and I tore it out in big, ugly hunks. There was no care for the fragility of it, no concern for the fact I was taking every single thing this person had ever been from the time his soul gelled in his body until this instant. Good, bad, saintly, evil, every scrap of his contribution to the human condition, I pulped it, stealing it from the great wheel of karma, from his final judgment with his creator, from the Godhead, take your pick of whatever flavor you subscribe to. I was God in this bloody arena of doors, and I had judged. The man's soul shattered and fragmented like a snowflake made of sponge sugar and light. I took the raw, undefined life force, the ineffable spark that changes a living, animate, aware being into a pile of rotting meat, and I pumped every iota of it into the dying dog. I felt the fading flame in the pit jump and sputter at the infusion of raw life. The dog's life force struggled, fought, and finally fortified. The pit lay on his side. His breathing was strong, his eyes closed, and he slept. I patted his flank gently and stood up, trembling from the anger and the effort, a little high and feeling indestructible after the stolen life energy had channeled through me. I noticed the wedding ring on the finger of the soulless man. For a second I thought of going through his pockets, taking a look at the life of the person I had just erased. The cherry coals of my anger hissed, "Fuck him," and I did none of it. I climbed out of the arena and headed toward the voice, headed toward Duane. I found him in one of the two bedrooms on the ground floor. The walls were covered in dripping spray paint gang tags, and the air was thick with the smell of dog shit and death. There were steel wire pet crates, about half a dozen in this room, stacked on top of each other. Half the dogs in them were dead. The others, four fierce, muscular, scarred veterans of the arena, were quiet. They didn't bark at my entrance. They didn't growl or flinch in fear. They were surrounding a man sitting cross-legged on the filthy floor. He was rubbing and loving on the dogs, and they were eating up the first genuine affection most of them had ever received in their lives, licking and nuzzling the man.
"Hey, Ballard," Duane said.
Duane Perez Walker Lee was beautiful. I've yet to meet anyone living who disagreed with that statement. He was the best parts of several different ethnicities, African-American, Mexican, Chinese, Japanese, and Pacific Islander. His long, thick black hair was clumped in dreadlocks, and he wore a fringe of a black beard and mustache. He was a shade over 6 feet and built as solid and muscular as these fighting dogs. His eyes were hazel, and he wore a frayed gray hoodie, baggy black shorts that fell to his knees, and leather sandals. Resting next to him was his badge of office, a length of steel rebar wrapped in strips of colorful but weathered duct tape. A Barbie doll head was mounted on the top of the staff, colored in various hues of ancient faded Sharpie and covered in glitter. The hair on the doll's head was half shaved off. Radiating from the base of the doll head were small chains like those used in toilet tanks. They hung with various charms on them, seashells, bottle caps, pigeon feathers, and old bus tokens.
"Hey, Duane," I said, "you busy?"
"Not anymore, brah," he said.
There was no malice, no harsh edge to his voice. He sounded for all the world like a stoner surfer, innocent, at peace, even though he had just single-handedly slaughtered close to 50 people in this house without anyone getting off a shot. A large black dog with white paws, a German Shepherd pit bull mix, stood behind Duane. The dog was uninjured, clean, and not half-starving. She had been with Duane as long as I could recall.
"Hi, Gretchen,"
I said to the dog. Gretchen narrowed her eyes and growled lowly at me. "She still fucking hates me," I said. "Even after all these years, your dog hates me, Duane."
"Hate's harsh, man," Duane said. "She just knows when you show up, we tend to get put into some ugly predicaments, Ballard."
Gretchen made it sound like glomp in agreement.
"So tell me, brah, is she wrong this time?"
"No," I said. "She's an excellent judge of character. I need your help, Duane."
"No shit, man,"
Duane said, continuing to rub and stroke the abused animals. I could feel the power shifting between his fingers, like invisible sand, as he was gently healing and soothing these dogs' pain as best he could.
"You definitely need some help. I felt what you did in there, Ballard, and that was majorly uncool. That's unnatural, man. You're going to end up junking up what little bit of soul you got left."
"Yeah," I said, "thanks. I'm not really looking for a morality lesson from a guy who worships the expressway toll plaza."
"Hey, brah, everything has a spirit," Duane said. "There's voices in the concrete, whispering, burning rain in the power grid. The lotto is the numerological oracle, and the traffic jam is the great serpent uncoiling across the land. Life finds its way, brah, anywhere, everywhere. The city is every bit as alive as the forest, the ocean, or the desert, and this city has a heartbeat. She's good and loyal to those who love her back and treat her right, who listen. I was just born with better ears than most. She's beautiful. You know that, Ballard? You used to love her, true. What you just did in there, it's against life. Against nature, against the cycle. You know that, man. You feel it. You act like you don't care, but I know your heart, man, and you do."
The asshole was betting blood sport on innocent animals, I said. "The hell with him, Duane."
"Your people find out you did that, and they're going to fuck you up, brah,"
he said. "Look," I said, "I need to sit down with this guy who does business with MS-13. Drag his own board to get me in, but I could really use your help. Duane, what do you say?" Duane looked to Gretchen. The German pit made a sound like, "Oomph."
"Gretchen says I should shine you on, man.
Oh, cut the shit, Gretchen, I said. I tossed the accumulated loose weed tie sticks and joints I had scored from my fancy satellite earlier tonight at Duane's feet. This guy can help me find a runaway lost out there. She's a kid scared desperate on your streets. Duane, you know better than anyone the kind of two-legged predators hunting out there. Duane gave the fighting dogs a final scritch and looked to Gretchen as he stood gathering up the drugs.
Find me a cell phone off one of these losers to call the shelter on the cops, Gretch, he said.
Gretchen padded out of the room, giving me an indignant sniff as she passed me. I gave the finger to her back as she headed down the hall.
I'm pretty sure about 80% of what you just told me was bullshit, he continued. But if you're even doing 20% good, that's better than your usual average. And your ass needs all the karma you can get, Bruss. Okay, we'll help.
Thanks, I said. We need to get moving. Hitting those MS-13 assholes at dawn was probably the best way to do this.
Yeah,
Duane said, as Gretchen returned with a smartphone in her mouth. Duane took it and patted her.
We'll try to do this all quiet and cool, Ballard, but we might want to get our hands on Boku hardware in case it goes sideways. Some of those MS-13 guys are Nahuali, Aztec sorcerers, and trust me, brah, you do not want to piss with them or their creepy-ass gods.
He swiped the screen of the phone and began to dial a number. Duane, I said, man, there must be like 50 guns or more lying around this house, all loaded, never fired, only dropped once, remember?
Oh, yeah,
the man responsible for all the carnage said, nodding as he put the phone to his ear.
I kind of forgot. I don't do hardware unless I got a, hello? Hi, I wanted to... like, report some nasty-ass illegal dogfighting and, oh yeah, a bunch of, like, dead assholes.
He pulled the phone away from his face.
Yeah, we're gonna need a trash bag or maybe a laundry basket to put the hardware in.
There was a tiny voice speaking on the phone.
What? No, man.
Duane said as casually as if he were ordering a pizza.
Sorry, I wasn't talking to you. No, I said dogfighting, then murders. Get it straight, man.
I looked at Gretchen and she cocked her head at me. I shrugged and started gathering up guns as the sky outside crept closer to dawn. 11. Sherman Oaks was west of Studio City and decapitated by the 101. Located in the San Fernando Valley, it was a quiet little oasis of suburban calm and the pretentious smog of hipster pollution and the staccato machine pistol frenzy of gangbang chaos. It was the kind of strip mall, chain restaurant, PTA place to which you'd flee to raise a family, so naturally it was the perfect place for the particular strain of MS-13 I was hunting to hang out. The Mara had bought a ranch compound on about an acre of land just off Round Valley Drive. On the way over in a cab, I texted Dragon the address of the gang safe house. Me and Duane are on our way there now to pry Luis Demir away from some MS-13 mouth breathers, I typed. We'll need evac, most likely a garbage run. Our ETA's about 20 minutes. 3 minutes later, I got a curt text reply from Lauren. Asshole. I looked over to Duane as I put the secure smartphone away. We're golden, I said. It was about an hour after dawn when Duane, Gretchen, and I knocked on the front door of their house. A young man, maybe 20, opened the door. His face was tattooed with various slogans in Spanish and large stylized letters, MS. He had shaved his head, presumably to have more canvas space. He wore no shirt and had the black eagle off the Tecate beer logo, wings spread and talons dripping blood covering his muscular chest. I thought to mention misappropriation of intellectual property to the gentleman, but somehow I managed to hold my tongue. The kid had the butt of a pistol jutting out of the sagging waistband of his baggy jeans. He looked pretty much how I looked, like he had been hitting it hard all night and now just wanted to crash equally as hard. He reeked of weed. What the fuck? He said in Spanish. How'd you assholes get past the fucking gate?
Hey, bro,
Duane said, replying in Spanish. He was holding Gretchen's chain leash, and the German pit was sitting quietly by his leg.
My name's Duane. I'm here to see Nestor.
Nestor's in the fucking hospital with a machine breathing for him, the kid said. He got hit, took two in the chest.
Shit, man, I'm sorry to hear that,
Dwayne said, and he meant it. The kid grunted and narrowed his eyes. I don't give a fuck, he said, his face stone. Stupid motherfucker too fucking slow to not get his ass shot don't mean shit to me.
Well, maybe I can talk to you,
Dwayne offered. The kid was having none of it. Somewhere down the hall, past Mr. Compassion, I heard male voices shouting back and forth to each other. Something about where the fuck was the milk for the Cocoa Puffs. Music started up down the hall. Wake Up by Immortal Technique. Who the fuck are you, you dog-walking, blazing motherfucker? Come up to my house, jump my fence, don't know you from shit. Got some junky-looking vieja pera blanca with you. We actually wanted to share the good news of Jesus Christ with you, if you have a few moments, I said in English. Are your mommy and daddy home?
Shit,
Dwayne said, his unflappable cool slipping for a second.
Ballard, shut the fuck up, man.
What did you just say, you maricón? The kid sputtered, reaching for his gun. I drove a knuckle into his Adam's apple. He gagged and gasped. Grabbing instinctively for his throat, I took his gun away from him, cocked it, and aimed it at his lowered head. There was a chorus of oiled snicks, and we now had a half dozen guns pointed at our heads from a half dozen dead-eyed tattooed faces.
No disrespect intended,
Dwayne said in Spanish, still sounding pretty cool.
We wanted to discuss some business with Nestor.
The kid stood glaring at me. I handed him the cocked gun back, butt first. Sorry, I said in Spanish. He dropped it, and I was just giving it back to him. I'm old. I have spasms. Chingo usted, the kid said as he aimed the gun at my face. A tattooed hand flashed out behind him and smacked his head hard. The kid winced and looked back. You fucking stupid, the older Mara member said. You know who the fuck this is you talking to? That's Dwayne, pendejo. He's a fucking bruja boy like Francisco. The older banger looked at all his brothers. Put those the fuck away. Dwayne's the one that healed Nestor's mama when she was in the hospital, and the insurance gave out on her, and he got Lonzo's sister Aleda back from those coyotes that were going to sell her. He's good. The name Francisco set off a little screaming fire alarm in my skull. Shit. Dwayne caught the shadow of recognition across my face, but he played it cool. Guns were put away, and most of the bangers drifted back inside, questing for milk for the cereal again. The kid I hit was still pissed, and he wanted payback bad. The older Mara member and Dwayne gripped in a complex handshake and then embraced, slapping backs.
Good to see you, Fabian,
Dwayne said. Fabian smiled and nodded.
You should call first, man, Fabian said, gesturing us inside. Who's your friend?
He asked as we walked down the hall. Gretchen stayed by Dwayne's side. I could hear the silent cop in Fabian's question.
Ballard, Fabian. Fabian, Ballard,
Dwayne said.
Ballard's cool. He needs to talk to one of your guys. No beef. Just trying to reach some understanding. That's why we came by. I'm sorry to hear about Nestor, brah.
Fabian gave me a curt nod and led us into an open and airy living room with high, wide windows giving a view of the sparsely wooded hills and canyons in the compound's backyard. Besides the MS-13s who greeted us at the doors, there was another group in here, close to 20 in all. These guys all looked like they were on the last legs of a night of partying. Empty liquor bottles, bongs, rolling paper, and flavored cigar wrappers were everywhere. There was enough coke and marijuana residue on the faux stone Aztec coffee tables to make the DEA's bust quota for a month. You guys move out here to the burbs for the better schools? I asked. Fabian gave me a sidelong look.
Who you need to see?
He asked, ducking the question. He sat down on a couch and offered us a pair of stuffed chairs. Luis, I said. Luis Demir. He's a black hat identity thief. He works for your Mara, among others. Fabian nodded.
Yeah, he's here, got into town a few days ago. He's got a workroom upstairs. Let me see what I can do.
Fabian stood and headed upstairs.
This is going to go to shit, I muttered to Dwayne.
Get ready. You too, Dragon, I whispered to her, knowing she was listening in through the scry wire, the mystic equivalent of a surveillance wire, a henna tattoo that I had Dragon draw an incant on my chest.
You're being all kinds of negative, brah,
Dwayne said, lowering his voice.
It's going to be fine. Fabian is righteous. Don't lose your shit.
Two of the MS-13 members near us yawned and passed the dregs of a bottle of Jack back and forth. I wished for the millionth time this morning that I hadn't been such a fuck-up last night.
Listen,
I hissed.
I know this Francisco they're talking about. He's one of those damn Nahuala you were talking about earlier, an Aztec sorcerer. He's nowhere near righteous.
Aw, shit, bro, really?
Dwayne said. Gretchen made a nervous sound, and Dwayne stroked her head to calm her.
You guys good? We wouldn't get that lucky.
I nearly fried his ass a few times back when I was not wise, I said. What the fuck do you think?
Well, that's disappointing,
Dwayne said matter-of-factly.
I was really hoping we'd get through this without any harshness.
I looked around at the groggy street soldiers at all the guns.
Yeah, me too,
I said. A dragon, Lauren, darling, get ready to crash the party. I'll give you the word.
Can we at least try to not hurt Fabian?
Dwayne said. I nodded. You hear that, Lauren? Try to not hurt this Fabian guy everyone else hurt the hell out of. Fabian descended the open staircase to the upper floor of the ranch. Following him was Francisco. He had changed in over 30 years. The long black hair was now gray. He was still slender, a little too thin, and there were shadows under his eyes, which were still merciless wells of pitch. I stood as he walked down the stairs, locking eyes with me. I already felt some of his power playing through his eyes at the edges of my awareness, a subtle testing. I returned the favor, but I felt brittle and off my game.
Latham Ballard, Francisco said. The years have worked you over, Holmes. Rough. You still got those balls, though, I see, walking into my house asking favors of me. You'll get Alzheimer's or something not wise.
Still like the junk, Francisco? I said, that shit'll eat your soul, put you off your game.
Shit, this coming from someone who gave away more of his soul than his mama gave away hand jobs.
Several of the Mara bangers laughed at this. I felt ice crack inside me.
Now, don't go bringing family into this, Frankie, I said. Otherwise, I might have to mention how your brother screamed like a little bitch when I cooked him from the inside out. You recall that, don't you, Holmes?
I didn't blink. My eyes were empty and evil, just like his. I felt the tiniest flutter of his pain, and I licked it up like a cat with cream.
Look,
Dwayne said, getting to his feet. Gretchen stood as well.
We don't want no war. We're just here to do some business. History is bad for everyone's money. You all know that. No future if we close each other's eyes over someone else's beef.
The MS-13 guys were up and aware shit might start flying, hands drifting to their pistols, shotguns, machine pistols. The Amazon Alexa near the bar was playing Hard Time by Proper Dues. Even the air was getting ready for this.
Ballard just wants to sit down with your mica maker, that's it. And he's willing to make it worth your time.
Is that so? Francisco said, stepping off the stairs. Fabian and Dwayne exchanged quick glances. Dwayne shrugged.
What's in it for us?
I already knew he wasn't going for it, and he knew I knew. Everyone in the room knew.
Well,
I said, lining up and opening my plexuses of power. I felt him doing the same, shields and wards dropping from that initial testing push. I left my defenses down and focused on building energy, taking the ragged scraps of spiritual energy in the room and the raw electromagnetic power of the universe. The room got colder. My breath trailed behind my words. You all get to live. You too, Frankie. I got no cause to end any of you. You're just the means to an end. I felt something old gather around Francisco, its power emanating from hot stone, bitter pulp and stained obsidian. He was summoning help from outside. The air around him got hotter, and you could smell the metallic tang of fresh blood. Several of the hardened gangsters whispered prayers or crossed themselves. I glanced at Dwayne. His eyes told me he was ready. I was less than 10 feet from Francisco.
I've missed this, Francisco, I said in Spanish.
He nodded. I nodded back.
Let's war.
The kid I fucked with at the door drew the pistol I took away from him, stepped toward me, aiming to blow my head off. He turned into screaming hot ash as he was caught in the first exchange between me and Francisco. Duane squeezed a tiny pin cable release on Gretchen's leash, and the chain disconnected from her collar. The dog launched herself at the throat of an MS-13 banger who was about to spray both Duane and me with an MP-UMP machine gun. The kid gurgled and screamed as he fell over, struggling with the German pit opening his neck. Duane snapped the leash chain in his hand like a whip and cracked the temple of one of the Mara killers. The chain bounced off the now dead man's skull with a flick of the urban shaman's wrist and blinded the shooter next to him, pulping one of his eyes. Duane cleared the distance between them and crushed his windpipe even as he was screaming about the lost eye. The banger's hand convulsed on his pistol's trigger, and Duane grabbed and aimed his rapidly drooping arm to shoot two more of the MS guys dead.
Yo lo tratec, nianquas,
Francisco commanded, his hand outstretched. I felt a horrible pain in my chest, like it was splitting. I flexed my Manipura chakra as I anchored myself with my Muladhara, and the pain decreased, but it had given me pause. Francisco pressed his attack. The otherworldly force he had entered hovered over him, ready to spike my spells back, but I had an idea about that.
Quatlo coclitli yi cucoqua,
he spat. My blood felt like it was beginning to burn in my veins, and I felt sick, like I was going to vomit. He had tried to turn my blood into venom. I closed the gap between us. I was close enough now to drive a right hook into his face. Francisco managed to block part of the punch, but not all of it. His head snapped to the side, and he grunted out a spell. Finestra aperta est et omnes legis ejus. Intratigrata, I said as I punched Francisco again, this time in the stomach. It was getting hard to see straight. The poison blood had done a number on me, but I needed to push through, no time to fall back. There were shouts from upstairs, the clatter and dull thuds of automatic weapons and grenade launchers as something crashed through the compound gates. Dragon had arrived. I wish I could have seen the look on the faces of the tired, drunk, stoned Mara members as an armor-plated 32-short-ton garbage truck blasted through, Lauren at the wheel. Duane and Gretchen tore through the MS-13 soldiers like a buzzsaw. Bodies and parts flew everywhere. The man and the dog moved in seamless coordination. More bangers were pouring down the stairs into the living room. Several of them fired on Duane as they descended, but he spun his body, twisting and snapping the chain. Impossibly, the chain was everywhere a bullet was supposed to be, knocking them off their path toward him. Duane launched himself up the stairs, plowing into the stunned mass of gunmen. Gretchen had Duane's back, finishing off the last of the gang standing in the living room, ripping at their shins and wrists, maiming them and disarming them. Francisco shoved me back, trying to get enough space to cast. He barked out a quick, dirty spell. And flowers of black fire spilled from his free hand, engulfing me in ebony flames. I felt my clothes begin to catch and smelled crisping hair, but I had to hold. I charged at him, low, with a roar, and felt my arms wrap around his legs in a football-style tackle. We both went down, and he began to burn, too. Coyonia, I began, speaking in the ancient Nahuatl, the language of Francisco's gods. Talaya Talamanali. No, Francisco shouted. The awareness of what I was doing fell on him. I had torn down his packs and wards with his own patrons. He was just another piece of sacrificial meat to his vengeful gods now, like the rest of us. I was offering him up along with myself if I died. Bloodthirsty gods hated getting played by mortal wizards, and they really couldn't pass up a twofer. Oh, tetchum papa papa quilty, I finished as I began to feel my skin redden and blister from the black fire. I grabbed a pistol off the floor, discarded by a now-dead banger. Francisco struggled with me, panic giving him strength. I jammed a thumb into one of his wide eyes, and he screamed and let loose of the gun long enough for me to double-tap two rounds into his chest. I rolled off him, both of us burning, me hacking and tossing the gun. Aquam mer git el anire flamma ignis, I gasped, and the wizard fire was gone. I was smoking and soaking wet. My burns stung, but they felt better, a temporary magical remedy. I leaned back and watched Francisco burn, as a proper sacrifice should.
Good to see you again, Francisco,
I wheezed. There was a loud boom, and the house shook. I was pretty sure that was our ride backing up to the front door. I struggled to my feet, pausing on my knees to puke. My blood still had more than your daily recommended requirement of magic venom. I knew the spell would unravel and fade now that Francisco was past tense, but in the meantime I felt like ass. I looked around at all the bodies and recalled why I had wanted Duane with me. He had already worked his way upstairs, and I noticed that it seemed pretty quiet in the house. I stumbled against the walls like a pinball until I reached the front door, unbarred it, and opened it. The garbage truck's interior, usually filled with garbage, was on the other side of the door. The compartment was clean and had benches for passengers. The walls of the chamber were packed with bulletproof blankets. I heard an intercom speaker hiss as the mic on the cab was keyed.
"You got him?"
Dragon asked. "Not yet," I said. "I ran into Francisco. You remember that asshole?"
"Yeah,"
Dragon replied with a hiss and click.
"You give him my love."
I looked back at the still-burning remains. "Yeah," I said. "I did."
"Okay. We got incoming LAPD and Sheriff's Department in about 4 minutes,"
she said.
"Get your answers and let's go."
I struggled up the stairs, pausing until a dizzy spell passed, and reached the second floor. More bodies and Duane and Gretchen leading a man in a Tom Brown suit and tie out into the hallway. He looked Middle Eastern. His haircut was short and professional, and he carried a dull, silver-armored case. He looked more pissed than scared.
"I was just bringing him down to you,"
Duane said.
"This guy gave me, like, 20 different names, but he was packing up and deleting computer stuff in there, and the computer told me his real name is Luis Demir."
"You looked him up using his computer?" I asked. Duane shook his head.
"No, bruh. The computer shot. The spirit in the computer actually told me. It's got a voice, man. We've discussed this."
"I don't know what sitcom you two fell out of," Demir said in flawless, unaccented English. Gretchen growled at him, showing blood-stained teeth.
"Three," I corrected. "She's touchy about that."
"But you have no idea how big the people are you just fucked with."
"Let me save you some time," I interrupted Demir. "I don't care about you or your business associates. You acquired identity data from a girl some years back. Her name was Karen Ankhu. She was in Greece at the time. You traded her identity for a fake one, and you got her off of Spetz's. I need all the info on that identity you cooked for her and where you last saw her." Demir shook his head.
"You set all this shit up for that? Are you fucking mental? You have any idea how many paper spoofs I do in any given month, a year? How many identities I farm or buy from paper farmers? You really expect me to remember one name out of hundreds of thousands, out of dozens of countries?"
I slipped the photo of Cairn out of the dry inside of my wallet. It was the one Dree had given me of them. I slammed Demir's head hard against the wall behind him. I was beginning to hear sirens, and I felt another wave of nausea churn inside of me. I shoved the photo into his face. "Okay, I'll make this easy for you, since you're such a busy man. One of the girls in this picture is the girl you helped out. One of the girls in this picture has a father with enough juice he makes you and your business associates look like fly shit, and who will personally oversee your vivisection if you don't help him and us, his humble representatives, find his daughter." I smashed his head against the wall again. "Is this thing on? Is this working? Anything coming back to you?"
"Okay, okay, shit,"
Demir said. The sirens were louder now, closer. I nodded for Duane and Gretchen to head on downstairs. They did. Demir knelt and opened the case at his feet. Inside, nestled in cut foam cradles, were hundreds of small, black, cylindrical, encrypted USB drives, each with a tiny numeric keypad on their face. Demir ran a finger along the rows and finally pulled one loose. He handed it to me.
"The key is," he closed his eyes, recalling, 2621985045.
"Ballard! Cops, brah!"
Duane yelled from the front door.
"I remember her," Demir said with a grin. "Sweet young thing, running away from something, burning down her old life, so she sold it to me, gave something else to me, too, on the boat. She was my little cabin pet for the whole trip. She fought for a little bit. I was her first. By the time we reached Portugal, she was broken in just fine."
A cold snake of bile and anger thrashed in my guts.
Part of it was the poison, but most of it was Demir.
You left her in Portugal? I said coolly. I was looking around the hall. Demir nodded.
Yeah, but she told me she was coming here. I toyed with the idea of selling her or keeping her for myself. She was a sweet little piece, but she bolted as soon as we were off the boat. End of story. You going to get me out of here now, or what?
The sirens were on top of us. Yeah, I said, gesturing toward the stairs. Go on, get to the truck. I was 13 in an 18-wheeler at a rest stop off I-64 just over the Kentucky line. He had picked me up, fed me, let me sleep in the warm cab when it was so cold outside. He put something in my food, and I couldn't move, couldn't think, while he touched me and made my body respond to his dirty, thick fingers all over it. He tore me as he entered me from behind. It felt like fire, like broken glass pushed by stone, like my insides were going to crush up into my heart, my lungs. I couldn't breathe. It hurt so bad, and I was so ashamed. I had the power of the stars and the planets, the whole universe turning inside me like a secret clock, and only I had the key to turn it, to make it spin, to slow, to stop, or to break the whole fucking thing. I was a young god, and I could do nothing while he stole the last shreds of me, not dipped in pain and loss and fear. Adult me knelt in the hallway as Demir descended the stairs and the sirens heralded consequence. I stood. Hey! I said. Demir turned to look back. He saw the pistol in my hand aimed at him. She was 13. I shot him in the head, and his face folded in as it disappeared. A dark mist sprayed out the back of his skull. He tumbled down the stairs and was still. I dropped the gun and headed down the steps. I almost fell. I was dizzy and sick. Everything seemed like a dream, and I had nothing left. I reached the bottom and started to turn toward the short hall, the front door, and the garbage truck. I sensed something was wrong and turned. The death hex sizzled the air as it bore into me. I reacted with nothing but animal instinct, trying to deflect it with raw power. No spell, no focus, no finesse, just my life screaming, "No!" If I hadn't stolen that tiny dram of life force in the transfer when I saved the dog's life, I'd be dead, courtesy of a spell designed especially for me. The blast took me off my feet, knocked me back into a wall. Everything in my chest felt broken and jagged inside as I slid down the wall and coughed, choking on my own blood. I heard Dwayne shouting and Gretchen barking. The sirens were a chorus of demons singing hallelujah as they opened the gates of hell for me. There was a man dressed in black, wearing gloves and boots. A hood hid most of his face. His skin was black and had pockmarks on the chin from a bad bout of acne. He wore a black nylon combat harness with various holsters, sheaths, and pouches all over it. Behind him, one of the large windows that gave a view of the mountains and canyons was melted. He seemed impressed I was still alive. He casually fired a blast down the hallway from the completely, magically, silent machine pistol in his hand. I thought I heard Dwayne shout and dive back for cover. The assassin was standing in front of me, bringing the machine pistol up to my head. The gun was covered in arcane runes, and I was pretty sure the bullets in it were, too, built special to deal with folks like me. Some part of my brain that hadn't already shut down knew this had to be the Carnifex, the hitman that Anku's rivals had sent. I looked up and could see his eyes under the hood. They were yellow, the color of strong piss. There was no gloating, no smart-ass lines. He was just going to pull the trigger, and that would be that. You can't cast a death hex for shit, I muttered, blood spilling out with my last words. Another of the windows behind us exploded as a figure flew into the room, wreathed in a million tiny slivers of glass, all reflecting the morning sun. It was Vigil, and he had a pistol in either hand. A bullet from one of them had shattered the window. He pumped three bullets into the assassin's back with the gun in his other hand as he hit the floor and tumbled behind one of the couches. The Carnifex had defensive magics, bullet wards and the like, but I was certain Vigil's guns were enchanted, too. In a war of magic weapons, the side with the most money usually won.
A hot spray of the Carnifex's blood hit my face and chest, even as he dove for cover behind a steel and glass entertainment center. My vision was narrowing, but I saw the Carnifex touch a rune on the machine pistol, and the rune glowed for a moment. The hitman whispered something to the warm metal of his gun. He held his arm out straight up and pulled the trigger, letting slip a burst of silent fire and a swarm of bullets. The bullet zipped skyward, then twisted in midair and headed for the other side of Burris's couch. There was a series of dull,